it's said that mindfulness, the practice of mindfulness, when I say that, maybe some people go like, don't say this word again. That's enough already. If you say it one more time, I'm going to explode or implode. But it's said that the practice of mindfulness shouldn't be tiring. Should be, if we get tired as we do it, it's because, I don't know if some of you have this experience. I remember some years ago when I was practicing, I was getting exhausted. I didn't have the right effort yet, but I think also that there was the presence of a lot of difficult mind states that it was really exhausting to look at, like wanting something else than what is there, not wanting what is there, you know, being confused about what I want really, and getting exhausted and then agitated because I'm exhausted and I want to be present in a balanced way, you know. And it was very exhausting. So maybe still is sometimes, but a lot less. So all these difficult mind state that can visit us can be exhausting. Here's a quote from the Buddha. My friends, it is through the establishment of the lovely clarity of mindfulness that you can let go of grasping after past and future, overcome attachment and grief, abandon all clinging and anxiety, and awaken an unshakable freedom of heart here and now. And so today and tomorrow, I'd like to talk about four aspects of our lives where we can get caught, tight around, freak out about, bugged by, and four areas of our lives also where we can gain with attention, with inquiry and exploration of these very aspects of our life, where we can gain amazing sense of freedom from what can actually bind us, be difficult to be with. And so this is one of the classic Buddhist lists. It's called the Four Attachments. And when we prepared the promotion for this workshop, well, maybe we should try to make it a little positive. Four kinds of freedom. So this is not just, you know, June, Brock, Margot and I sitting here, but other people join us, you know, in the search and discovery of freedom. So today I'd like to talk about these, today about the two first of this list of four, and tomorrow about the two others, but I'll still name them. Or should I just hold on and just go ahead for a few minutes to build the suspense? What are they? What are they? So the list of the four attachments is attachments or clinging to sense pleasure, how we can get hooked by pleasantness. Do you recognize anything in there? And how we can get hooked by views and opinions. So that's today, and tomorrow we'll go further in looking at how we can get hooked, clinging, attached, and confused, and all wrapped up around conventional reality. And the last one will be this whole area of self, I, moi, mine, appropriation, identification, how this can lead to a lot of stress, and how insight into this deeper understanding of what's going on can foster, I use this word a lot this weekend, foster a lot of freedom, or help find freedom and ease in our lives. Yeah. And so let's look maybe for a few seconds at this word clinging or attachment. There's a a common understanding of how to find happiness in our society, we could speak about it this way, is through thirst. There's something that I want, you know, I really want this, and when I get this, I'm going to be happy. You know, might want that job or a child, or in my case, I remember a few years ago, I don't know why this just jumped to mind, but I travel a lot, so I had this idea that I could find the perfect suitcase. And so I was thinking about what would be the perfect suitcase, you know, and then I got online, I thought, oh, I'm going to look for, so it had a certain size and a certain weight. Well, I didn't know the technology of it, but through a whole evening on the internet, I discovered a lot about suitcases. And and I had in my mind, if I get the right suitcase at the right price also, then I'll be happy. I really had that. I mean, I would not have said that like this in a conversation. You know, I would have hidden it. But still, that was the core belief, was like, give me the right suitcase and I'm a free man. So I remember, like, at some point, like, I don't know, like 3 or 4 hours into this, I don't know, like, I was exhausted. And I just wanted, give me any suitcase. But I had built some kind of desire and expertise around suitcase, you know, and now I remember at some point I was just tired, and I went through this whole thing, the visa thing on the internet, to buy that suitcase. And at the end, I was just really, I clicked on, like, okay, send me the suitcase now. I'm so tired. And then I pressed, and it came like, error, you know. So I was like, no. I didn't care so much about the suitcase. I just wanted the end of desire. I just wanted to be finished with that craving, you know, because it was so painful at some point. But the mind can do this. Certainly my mind, you know, I won't put this on you, but so in generally it's presented, especially in advertisement, you know, when you get that car, then you'll be young and beautiful and happy and free on the highway somewhere in Arizona, usually, you know. And so there's a common understanding that this thirst will bring happiness. And in Buddhism, it's quite the opposite. The finding of deep happiness is through non-thirst. Yeah. The word that is used in Pali is tanha for this clinging or attachment. And sometimes we think that the source of my misery, of my trouble, is many. You know, the flat tire, or this person in my life, or that thing at work, or that, you know, we think that the... And in Buddhism we say, no, it's one thing. It's actually a mental event. It's a small little thing that happens in the mind that creates all the misery that we experience. And the beauty about it is that if it's a mental event, through this lovely clarity of mindfulness, we might be able to locate it, taste it, you know, get to know it, the contour and the inside of it, and at some point maybe release it here and there and everywhere, so that we can find some freedom. Because the happiness that we talk about in Buddhism, the bar is pretty high, you'll agree with me, you know, unconditional freedom, a freedom that doesn't depend on what are the current conditions, you know. And so, yeah, the bar is pretty high, and so that's the thing we want to look at is this clinging. There's another word, grasping, the word in Pali is upadana, and so tanha is known as, the literal translation is thirst. Like being thirsty, you know, there's something missing, this experience of lack. It's so interesting that this kind of desire, not all kinds of desires, some desires are healthy, but this one that comes with attachment and clinging, a need to have that. It's very funny that it seems that it talks to us about happiness. But when we look at it directly, when we're in it, you know, suitcase craving, it's actually an immediate experience of lack. Guy Armstrong, I think, talks about the built-in frustration factor in this kind of greed, it's called, this kind of wanting something. Yeah? And its opposite, that is also clinging, is rejecting, resisting something. So these are all aspects of clinging that we need to discover in experience. So when we're in the midst of it here or in our lives and we can bring some mindfulness, it's good to actually, that's the way I'll say it, soak in it a bit. To feel it when I'm attached to something in the clinging way, that I can actually take a moment to feel it. Ah, it has this texture or flavor or felt sense. Yeah. There's a teacher of mine, and she says, usually when you think about something three times, it's because there's some clinging going on. I thought that was a really good little indication. So I'm sitting here and thinking, tonight, I think tonight will be a good time for this. Interesting. What's going on? There's a little clinging to something. So that could be an indication. So clinging can be very, very small, so much so that we don't feel the hurt yet. But when the thing that I'm clinging to disappears or changes, maybe that's where it will become obvious, the misery of clinging. So let's look a little bit at the first area. So I'm throwing ideas here. I've been throwing ideas for already a few hours now. So, you'll make up your own patchwork of what I'm sending in your way. And if there's some things that escapes you, let the ideas roll through, and you'll make connections with things, don't cling to understanding everything. I'm saying I don't either myself. So this first area of pleasantness at the sense door. So here's the kind of the standardized reaction that we might have when something pleasant happens. When there's a pleasantness at the ear door, at the eye, nose, taste, in the body, or in the mind, pleasant ideas. It says that not all the time, and it's good to see when it happens and when it doesn't happen, but one tendency that can get activated when something pleasant happens is that there can be this clinging, that the wanting to keep, to get more of, yeah? And you can feel this sometimes happening. And sometimes, no, there's something pleasant happening, and there's a kind of a wholesome or sane relationship to it. It's pleasant, tastes good, period. So we even have access more to the pleasantness of it, because there's not the, like that, So that's one tendency that can be activated. Maybe I link this back to earlier conversation when I was saying, we have senses, and when there's an experience of a contact with an object of the eye, a visual object, and the eye and the consciousness, when these three comes together, this contact, the kind of juiciness of it that comes with being a human being is that it comes with pleasantness or unpleasantness, or neither one or the other, but it's also known, the neutrality. So every experience that we have comes with some taste of pleasantness or unpleasantness, or neither one or the other, or both sometimes. And so the tendency that can easily be activated when it's pleasant is the want more of. Do you recognize this in your own experience sometimes? Yeah? And when two tendencies can be activated when it's unpleasant, that's very interesting to notice also. So something unpleasant happened, and there's a shutting down, a not wanting, a rejection of some sort. Fear might arise, or defensiveness, or a sense of like, I need to attack, get rid of, destroy, I use strong words, but there's this. And sometimes it's, I'm sitting here, let's say in meditation here, and there's some kind of unpleasant squeak that comes from this area. And it's like, you could feel sometimes just the unpleasantness purely, but sometimes it comes with don't like, don't want. And it's not, sometimes it comes with words, but sometimes it's just very much felt, like I don't want that, Sometimes you're talking with somebody, and then the conversation is going well. Suddenly they say something, I don't want to hear that, you know. Or there's a little discomfort, you don't know what the person is saying exactly. And then it's disagreeable. And you're like, I don't like this situation when I don't know what somebody's saying and I'm not sure I can ask. Or some, you know, there's thousands of variations of unpleasantness like this. So the first tendency that is often activated is a resistance. That's a kind of clinging. So it's and there's a second tendency that it said can be activated. And the second tendency is to look for pleasure. In one of the texts, it says the worldling, the untrained mind, doesn't know any other way to be with the unpleasant than to close down or shut down and doesn't know any other way than to look for pleasure. The untrained mind doesn't know any. So an example that I'll use here is that I might see myself doing, or you might see yourself, or I might see yourself doing. There's a conversation on the phone and something is not pleasant. So there's the hanging up of that with one hand and with the other hand opening the fridge door. Do you notice this? I mean, that's one version, but, you know, or there's working on the internet and, you know, some kind of boredom or, anyway, it's unpleasant at this point. And I just open another page to suitcases, you know, something like this, just to, because the don't know any other way than to bring pleasantness to avoid feeling the displeasure. And this is in the text written 2,500 years ago. I find it fascinating that this is still active today in many of us, you know. That's what leads to compulsion and addiction and so different kinds of behavior. So to see this in oneself, you know, or you're sitting here and there's some pain in the lower back or in the knee and you go in some fantasy about the perfect holiday, you know, somewhere, cabin if that's your thing, or five-star hotel if that's your thing, you know, but an exit from the difficult by attaching to the pleasantness, to looking for some pleasant. So I find these tendencies very interesting to see in life how they manifest. And there's one kind of joy in this practice that we call vipassana joy, the joy of practice, where one way that it manifests for me is like suddenly I see this teaching in action in this being. It's like, it's kind of bad news, but also in a way, I don't know if fun is the right word here, but wow, look at that. This is an untrained being turning towards pleasure because they don't know any other way to be with the unpleasurable. It's amazing we do that. And so again, linking with what I was, that we were talking earlier about this being having senses always open. So there's always this stimuli that is a word that is, I'm not even sure of the meaning, I have to look for it, but impinging upon. We're always impinged. That's what we read in the text all the time. We're impinged upon the sense doors all the time. And so this happening, it kind of makes sense that one, knowing that there's pleasantness and unpleasantness and neutrality, that one would kind of aim for pleasantness, you know, try to maximize the pleasantness. And so that's in the Buddhist thought, this middle path, this is one of the extremes of indulging, putting all eggs in the same basket of pleasantness, trying to, okay, it's not easy being a human being, let's add as much pleasantness as we can, you know, experiences on top of one another, so that that's the way to find happiness. So it's the extreme of indulging. Yeah. So when we start to pay attention, what we'll find is that the pleasantness this pleasantness at the sense door, pleasant ideas, pleasant sound, pleasant, and sometimes it's an amalgamation of these. You know, this person smells good, sound good, look good, and they present beautiful ideas, you know, and something like this, it's a mixture of all the senses, or a situation seems like it's going to be extremely pleasant for many reasons. Yeah. So what we find when we become very attentive is that this pleasantness that is compared by the Buddha as a bubble, that's the image that he uses when he talks about this feeling tone, the pleasantness, unpleasantness, he says, it's like a bubble, it pops, it's impermanent, shaky, conditional, contingent, it's low quality pleasantness. Usually it's a flash of pleasantness, even the idea sometimes, the idea like, oh, this, there's a flash of possible pleasantness, and then they can be like, I want that. I'm going to put so much energy into getting this thing, you know, whatever it is. And to find out that it's very conditional. It can change easily. I'll give you a kind of a dramatic example here. Last summer, I had the chance with my partner at the time to go to spend the day at a river outside of Montreal. Beautiful summer day, we go to this river, it's all green, and there's these waterfalls there that are very beautiful. And at that time, early summer, the pressure on the waterfall is such that coming from the right angle, you can go under the waterfall, and there's in front of you like a kind of a sheet of water. The light is diffused, and you feel like you succeeded in going under, and it feels good, you know. And so it was very pleasant. We bring a lunch, there's these beautiful rocks, and all these different waterfalls that you can go under. And so we're playing under this. And at some point, my partner is sitting on the... So very pleasant. Partner is sitting on the rock, and I've decided, I'm going to take a few pictures of the waterfall and the partner. So at this point, you probably got that I'm a gay man, and the partner is a man. Anyway, make this clear. It will become clear in a few seconds. Anyway, so I would take a few snapshots of my partner, and at this point we haven't kissed or anything. We know exactly how to behave in social situation, you know. But in my mind, taking pictures is quite safe, you know. There's a group of young men on the other side of the river, and they recognize something in the taking of picture. It's something a little too romantic here, and not enough in the norm, you know. You know, being free young people, and they decide to express themselves. So they start to pretty rough language, and it's very interesting how the pleasantness of the waterfall didn't change. It was the same pressure. The sun didn't go away. The green didn't turn, you know, dark. You know, black. You know, it stayed green. But suddenly there was no more access. The pleasantness, although the thing itself hadn't changed, what was bringing the pleasantness was not exactly in the waterfall. It was somewhere in the mind, you know. It was received. Suddenly it was not pleasant anymore. There was a real sense of danger being in the forest, isolated, no access to, you know. It was an unpleasant situation to be in. Funnily enough, the waterfall was still going on, you know. But so that's how shaky the pleasantness at the sense door is. Or imagine somebody caressing your hair, somebody that you have affection for and tenderness for. They're caressing your hair, and then they stroke your hair, stroke your hair, like 3 hours later. The actual pleasant, you know, the thing hasn't changed, but the relationship to it has changed. So the pleasantness is dependent on many conditions. You know? And so we can see that this pleasantness is not so reliable. I cannot invest so much into this because it's low quality. Plus, it's stressful. It's known to be stressful because it says when you want to get the pleasantness, it's stressful because you're not sure you recognize that you might not get this pleasantness. So it's stressful to think about it. To try to get it is stressful. If you don't get it, it's clear that it's disappointing. You know, you failed in a way. You know, to get that hit of enjoyment. And if you get it, it's also stressful because it might not stay. You know, and it's going to go away. And so it's amazing in this way how it's not really reliable. And so what is reliable? What has more depth? So to me, at the waterfall, maybe something that became more clear was a sense of clarity about what I find acceptable and not, and what I think is of value. And so there was this. It took some time because there was shame came in, you know, in the experience of the mind and confusion. But at some point, something got back. Was like, yeah, the importance maybe of friendliness in the heart for one being, of kindness for one being, of accompanying one being, of clarity about what is what and what is worth fighting for and what is not worth fighting for. And I don't know if I'm talking about it right, but I think you might be able to get the sense of there was an inner clarity that there was no need for shame here, that it was fine, and there was a need for protection, you know, and there was no intention of clearly no intention of retaliation or something like this, you know, there was some kind of confidence, I would say, that I could touch inside. And so it's known that there's some qualities of the mind that have more value than the shaky, contingent pleasantness that we can feel in being alive and through the senses, you know. Some qualities of, generosity, other qualities that are being developed here, wisdom, clarity of mind, courage, the capacity to meet experience, you know. So for me, maybe at the waterfall, there was this sense like, okay, this is what's happening right now. What is the appropriate response here? What is the right thing to do, you know? And then for many people, it could be different answers, but there was something I could rely on, it seems. For me, it was very much related to the years of practice before. I was like, oh, there's a ground, you know? I'm not groundless here. I can think of an appropriate... What is in line with my values, you know? Staying alive is one value that I have at this point, you know? And in the end, nothing much more than that happened, you know, but it was there. So we say that easily a possibility of addiction that comes with the pleasantness because of the real enjoyment. It's not like it's not enjoyable. When it's pleasant, we know it. We have the full experience of the pleasantness. But it's unlike, it's said in the teaching, it's unlike, a sharp object where it's, or a blazing fire where it's clear, the danger is clear. In the pleasantness at the sense door, the danger is kind of hidden because of the pleasantness. And an image that is used that I so didn't like the first few years I encountered it was saying, it's like licking honey on a razor's edge. And I was like, oh, don't give me that, you know? And now sometimes I can see it. It appears in my mind like, oh, yeah, I can see that the enjoyment can lead to clinging. And there's going to be suffering. If there's clinging being the cause of stress and suffering, there's going to be suffering at some point. So we have to be careful here not to think that pleasantness is to be avoided at all costs. That would be a wrong understanding. That's the other extreme. And one extreme is indulgence. The other is like, pleasantness is dangerous. Let's make sure we don't feel any of it. Pleasantness comes in life. It's one of the winds, you could say, of pleasantness and unpleasantness. Sometimes it's presented like this. But it's the clinging that is the danger. So how can we have a sane relationship with pleasantness or unpleasantness? Because to the extent that we're invested and want pleasantness in our life, to the same extent it's unavoidable, we're going to fear unpleasantness. And that's a difficult situation to find oneself in, knowing that there's constantly pleasantness and unpleasantness, that I would fear the possible unpleasantness, the unpleasantness that is there, and that I would want pleasantness that is hard to reach and shaky or unreliable, changing. You know, it's that's the experience of many human beings, and many of us a lot of the time, you know. Anyway, see for yourself. And with these teachings, very important, ehi pasiko is the word. See for yourself. Do not believe anything that is said here. Don't be fooled, you know. Consider for yourself. This is the beautiful teaching of the Buddha, the way I understand it. It's this tool of mindfulness. This tool of mindfulness is to gain independence so we can see for ourselves, because there's a we learned a way to be attentive, to be extraordinarily attentive to what's happening, so we can find for ourselves what is true and what is not. We don't have to believe anything. We can look, consider, and see for ourselves. Yeah. And this greed or this rejection or fear, and sometimes when we feel it, and we connect, we bring some attention to it, we can feel how difficult it is to be in the grip of wanting something to be different or wanting something not to be like this. It shouldn't be like this, you know. It should be otherwise, you know. This difficulty, we can feel it. But it's not only difficult to feel. These tendencies of the mind are known to be latent, kind of dormant in ourselves. And what they tend to do sometimes, and see for yourself if it's true or not, but what I've noticed is that sometimes these senses that we have, these six senses, in a way they can be, I think they can be very noble tools to discover what is this life, what it is to be a human being, yeah? Can be an amazing, that's the only entry way we have, you know? To be attentive to sight and sounds and ideas as it they cross the mind, and we can use the senses to find freedom, release stress. But too often, check for yourself, these senses become radars, are hijacked by greed and aversion, so that what we do with the eyes is look for something pleasant. Have you ever seen this? I see this sometimes, like Joseph calls it, like sometimes a catalog consciousness. You know, little bored, open the catalog. I don't know, there's not as many catalogs as there used to be. You know, and turn the page, looking for something pleasant to want or need. You know, and so the senses sometimes can be hijacked like this. So they become distorted. They become hungry for satisfaction. Anyway, if you notice this, you could check it out and see if that happens. Okay, so maybe I'll switch to the second area. So that's pleasantness at the sense door, yeah? And these areas of like sense pleasure, views and opinions, conventions and ways to do things and things like this we'll talk about, and the selfing, in the theory they're separated, but sometimes in the reality they get a little bit mixed up, you know? So, I don't know, imagine somebody comes in here and they come in and they say, hey, what's going on here? You know? Suddenly it could be felt as unpleasant, and I could cling to like, suddenly I would have an idea about, but you don't do something like this. You know, I have a thing about convention, suddenly it's like, you don't do something like this. And so there's a view and you're disrupting my retreat. So there's a mying going on. So it's kind of compounded, you know? And so sometimes it happens like this. There's something you want to say or ask?
Grasping in practice.
In practice? Yeah. Like grasping to mindfulness, for example. I should be mindful. When the mindfulness is not and made to be an object of grasping, you know, but we can turn it like this. Sometimes there's a self-righteousness, maybe, let's see, around the precepts that we didn't talk about at the beginning of this retreat today. But there's like, I don't tell lies, you know, but you do. And so something very beautiful that is meant to protect us in a society or in a community suddenly is hijacked and there's clinging around it. So I speak the truth, you don't, you know, or something like that, you know, where there's a clinging to something, to a practice, you know. So, yeah. And sometimes as we sit, there'll be... I'm sitting here, the whole morning was, the mind was all over the place, then we have lunch, then I come back, suddenly there's ease in the mind, and the agitation has gone away for some reason. And instead of just getting to know it in a sane and wholesome way, pleasantness or ease feels like this. Let me taste it and know the ease in the mind or this slight spaciousness that is there. The mind will start, that's good, this is practice, I got it now, you know. How can I get more of that? That's exactly it, you know. Like, I got it now. I'm a good meditator, you know. It's going to be like this now, forever. You know, whatever the mind will do with it, but there can be a clinging to it, and we can see right away that the enjoyment is gone because of the clinging. The clinging removed the the beautiful sunset. I don't have my camera, and I'm alone. You know, like the enjoyment of the is not possible because there's stress that arises in the mind, as if there was like, wow. Sunset, so impermanent, almost gone, you know. And the feeling, the being touched by it, there might be like a bittersweet taste that comes with it, like the knowing of the impermanence of it. So when pleasantness is met with a full mind, we know how fleeting it is, and we can enjoy it, but we don't rely on this for feeling complete in a way, because that's not going to bring completeness. It's going to go in a second, you know. So the second area then is views and opinion. And in the Buddhist thought, it says that it's very, very much linked to pleasantness and unpleasantness. Sometimes we'll think that my views and opinions are based on reasons, you know, they're very thought through. But the reality, if I check well, is that often they will be based in pleasantness. It's convenient right now to have this opinion. Or this view about something, yeah? I have another little, maybe edgy example of this is, sometimes I notice I'm watching the news on TV, and I get views about what's going on, you know, like about the war or about like, you know, something, and you could say like, okay, it's a view about peace. There should be peace. And the view itself is not a bad view, but it's not. I'll see images of war, of suffering, and there's a reactivity. It's unpleasant. I want it to stop. It's not based in compassion. There's no depth to it. It's not like being deeply touched by the suffering of other beings. It's just like pure reactivity. And so it's based in pleasantness, and in this case, unpleasantness. And it's good to actually see this. Okay, my view here is attached to a feeling tone. I want it to be pleasant. And can I drop a little bit lower than that, a little deeper, and be touched really more deeply, so that maybe the view will be the same, but it'll be based on wisdom, on compassion, rather than reactivity. Because in this teaching, it says that if it's based on reactivity, it's either going to be exhausting to feel, or it's going to lead to wrong or inappropriate response. You know, I'll start, what is the words? Ranting and raving in my living room. You know, and it's not going anywhere. It's just I'm having opinions about things, you know. As appropriate response is very different, is knowing what can have an effect on the world, you know, my suffering and the suffering of others, you know, and what is the right action to take, you know. And in the teachings I read somewhere, and that was kind of shocking for me, it was, and that's like contemporary commentary, so it doesn't come from the Buddha, but it was saying our views and opinions, and I think it's very much in line with the teachings, our views and opinions should lead to peace, calm, and freedom of the mind. And I put this against my views and opinion. It's like, oh, my views leads to often lead to agitation, restlessness, you know, and a lot of stress, you know. And that is interesting, that how it's presented. It says that. So again, it was not the pleasantness that was a problem, it's the clinging. So it's not the view necessarily that is a problem, but the clinging to view. Is there a way to have views without the clinging part to it? An example of this would be the Buddha, the way I understand it at least. Somebody who had loads of views and opinion, spent 45 years explaining his views and opinions, you know. But there was two things maybe to say about them, is that there was no clinging, you know. Earlier in the conversation I had with Margot, if you allow me, Margot, you were telling me about, telling us about in early Buddhist days of a woman practitioner who would say, like, I used to like to debate, you know, but I don't anymore. I'm not so much into debate. There's clarity in the mind, but not a clinging aspect to, like, well, you know. There's not this kind of clinging in the mind, but clarity. So the Buddha apparently didn't have any clinging around his views. And the second thing that is very important is that his views were wise. So it says that clinging to views is painful, but clinging to wrong view or wrong understanding of things is even more, you would say, maybe dangerous. So one kind of view that one can cling to is a view, a belief. This is a whole huge field, and each one of these four aspects that I'm talking about, I'm just like barely touching on them, just to plant a seed of exploration for you, maybe, or hopefully something of that nature. But so let's say there's this, the view that my actions have no consequences whatsoever. Not now, like nobody's seeing what I'm doing and it has no consequences. If I have this view, I'm in trouble, because everything that I'm doing with my mind is a training. That is a right view, that there's constantly a training of the mind, so that nothing is in parentheses, you know, apart from life, you know, that when I'm actually doing something, engaging in something with the mind, even here, I'm sitting here and worrying. I'm training worrying. And so it's important to become aware of that. Not cling to that, but become aware of that. So if somebody has the view that my action have no consequences, so I can take this, it doesn't mean anything, I deserve it, organize a view around something pleasant, you know, owning something that I want, then something is going to show up at some point that's going to reveal that I had wrong view and clinging to wrong view, and it's going to hurt myself or hurt others. Yeah? Or clinging to the view that this is solid, this is forever. Me and you, forever. or this is really mine. The view that this is really, truly mine. Mine, put anything there. Really anything, I'm totally open here. We're going to talk about this more, but my bike, my child, my partner, my house. If I really cling to the deep view that this is really mine, it's going to hurt at some point, because there's nothing that can truly, deeply, completely be owned. This is one right view or wise view from the Buddha. Or presented like this, check it out for yourself. Yeah? That there's nothing that can truly be owned, nothing that is truly lasting, solid. I'll tell you about, here's another dramatic story. So when I was 25, I had the view, and many of our views are hidden. We don't know about them. Many of our views or beliefs are, they're not. So my view that was destroyed in one meeting of a few minutes with the doctor one day. So I go to the doctor's office, and the doctor says, oh, you know, that doesn't look good at all. You know, that really doesn't look, it's actually not working at all, you know. And within a second, my view that I was healthy, I had the view that I was healthy and healthy forever. I would not again have said that in a conversation, but this was deep view that I had, that I was young forever, that I was healthy forever, and probably that I was never going to die also anyway. So in one go, these three views got shaken to the core, like deeply shaken. It was like, you don't have so much time to live, actually. You know, that's how I heard it. That's how it was presented. And so that I had the view that health was solid for me, you know. And suddenly it got shaken to the core. And I think that's why we do this practice, is so that we can start to question this. All these solid things can reveal their impermanent nature, conditioned nature. Their contingent nature. They depend on something else, you know. So they're unreliable in this way. Yeah. And so, and even there, if we have a right view, a wise view, it says that it's very dangerous if we cling to it. And in one text, it says, even for the, let me find it here. It says here, dispassion for passion. So dispassion for passion is talking about letting go of clinging. So that's how it's worded here. Dispassion for passion and dispassion for dispassion. So it's nothing she grasps at as supreme, nothing upheld as the highest. This is some of the highest teachings. So not even holding on to practice or to impermanence or to non-self, you know. Not even holding on to these, you know. So these were a few words on these two areas that we can maybe bring attention to in our lives as it's unfolding, our relationship to pleasant, unpleasant, and our relationship to views. And you can maybe just with views take a moment to maybe just close your eyes and just consider in your life, in different areas of your life, where is there a view or an opinion that you hold that is tinted or colored by clinging, by an attachment to that view? You know, and it can be around anything, about driving, transportation, about politics, views and opinions that you might have in your household, or ways people behave in different relationships or in society. Views and opinions that you might have around work, around education and raising kids. Just open yourself to revealing some of the views that I've clinging to them that happen in your life. Maybe things come to mind or not. Maybe later it will appear. You can open your eyes if you want. I've seen just what came to mind was in my family around around views and opinions around diapers, around soft soil shoes or hard soul shoes for kids. I mean, clinging to views around things like that, you know, and how much suffering can be created and separation. And, you know, I haven't talked to this one for a year because of diapers, or organic bananas. You know, it's amazing. So here I'm going to read just this to finish. Whatever being, that's an old text here, you'll recognize this maybe. Whatever being is greedy for fields, or put clinging there. Or whatever being is greedy for fields, property, or gold, cows or horses, relations, various objects of desire, the powerless overpower them. Troubles press them down. Thus unease comes to them like water into a broken boat. What is very powerful for me here is the powerless overpower them. If, for example, I believe that without this, I cannot be happy. Without this, fill in the blank there. Like, without, I cannot be happy. If you have this belief in your life, then the powerless overpowers you. That's amazing, yeah? And if I change the greedy here, whatever being is greedy for field but is clinging to, the powerless overpower them. So in my family, at some point, there was this debate about diapers. You know, it might have happened in other families too, you know. Diapers that you can wash or that you throw away. Yeah. And so at some point that we were overpowered by the powerless. You know, the powerless, a diaper, was overpowering my whole family. Amazing. Yeah? One time, I think, maybe 6 years, a few years ago, not so long ago, I was teaching at Samish Island, not too far from here, a few islands down there. And it was a little bit like now, a little later, I think. The rhododendrons were in full bloom. It was absolutely beautiful. And in my area of the world, the rhododendrons, they would like to be alive, you know, but they don't flower so much. And so I get to this place, and there was these huge trees of different colors, and I was amazed, you know, and people were saying, oh, it's the rhododendrons there. The weather has been amazing for a month, and it's light rain and cold, and so the rhododendrons haven't been hurt by hail and wind, and so it's beautiful. Plus, there was the herons flying all over the place, making their nest and eggs. And there was rabbits multiplying on the ground and swallows. Anyway, it was extremely pleasant. And we would sit like this in the med hall, get really quiet. And then I would ring the bell and stand up and go put my boots. And as I was putting my boots to go out, there would be like this energy, you know, coming from the window, like maybe there's another rhododendron or rabbits or herons in the sky, you know. And I could feel, you know, and I would go out and look. You know, look for rabbits and rhododendrons and herons. And at some point I noticed, this is really stressful being here. And then I read this thing, you know, whatever man is greedy for rhododendrons and rabbits and herons, the powerless will overpower him or her. I was like, wow, this is true, you know. And how many times do I do this in my life, you know, where, like, if you don't say this, you know, I won't be happy. You know, oh, these few words that I put all power into, you know. Anyway, something to reflect on. Okay. So let's just take a moment of silence to let the words dissolve. Buddha said, if it were not possible to free the heart from entanglement in greed, hatred and fear, I would not teach you to do so. Luminous is consciousness, brightly shining in its nature, but it becomes clouded by the attachments that visit it. So if it was not possible to free the heart from entanglement, I would not teach you to do so.